Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Good evening and welcome to Yada Ya. I'm just disgusted when I see the news. It is my conclusion that that Joe Biden may be the single most disastrous individual ever to occupy the United States White House. He announced this week that there are going to be a new series of actions targeted at reducing the racial wealth gap. The racial wealth gap. I want to ask you a question. What is the number one indicator, the number one indicator of the success of a child? He knows who his father is and he's raised by his father. It is the single number one overwhelming indicator of whether a child is going to be successful or fail. Really? He is raised by his father. He knows his father. His father plays a vital role in his life. Now, for all the women out there who have done a tremendous job as single parents raising their children, wonderful. Great for you. The single most important aspect of whether or not a child is going to be successful is they know their fathers. Their father played an active role in raising them. You know the problem of the racial wealth gap? Is that if you were to bring together 1,000 black children, African-American children, and ask them about their father, you know what the first word out of a black child's mouth is going to be? No. When a psychiatrist asks a African-American, a African person of African descent in the UK or in Africa itself, who is your father? The universal answer is no. Don't have one. Don't have a clue. What's the father? You want to know the problem that's driving the murder rate and the violence in the African-American community? Deadbeat dads. They're sperm donors and nothing else. They don't know how to be men. They don't know how to be fathers. They are not responsible. The racial wealth gap exists because there's a total and complete breakdown of the family unit in the African-American culture. You're not going to solve this by imposing penalties on those who are productive and rewarding those who have failed. If we want to have successful children, we need to stop rewarding failure and come up with societal standards that support families to stay together. Marriage. And, you know, I lived through an unhappy marriage, a miserable experience. And there is every reason that when you're unhappy to leave, but not until your children are born, are grown. You have a responsibility mm-hmm. to them. Stick with them. And then once they're raised, do whatever you want to do. But that's the problem. I watched a long, very long interview with two of the most brilliant minds probably of our time talking about the fact that the truth is so obvious and no one wants to talk about it. That it's exceedingly easy to explain why African-American boys and young men are 800% more violent than anyone else. Why they are responsible for murdering one another. Why they are dependent upon welfare at a much higher rate than anyone else. I haven't got a clue what it's like to be a man. I don't know their fathers. They're clueless as to what it means to be a man. And to be a man is to be responsible. It's to set a good example. It's to support and protect and guide your children. It's not that it's non-existent in the African-American community, but it's rare, exceedingly rare. These psychiatrists were talking about, and they said, you know, it's interesting, in the Asian community, an Asian immigrant can come to the UK, France, the United States, and within that first generation, they're independent and successful. The same thing would be true with an India from India family.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, when you ask young people in those communities, who's your father? They know. He said, these brilliant psychologists says, we've never asked that question, ever, in the Asian community or in the Indian community. And the child says, I don't know. But we are so corrupted with cancel culture and political correctness that all we know today is lies. Lies and excuses. And this nimbecile, that's the President of the United States, that was elected by fellow nimbeciles, wants to eradicate the racial wealth gap. And then we're in a self-imposed economic decline of monumental proportions. And the solution is to raise taxes on corporations. There's this bellyaching that, you know, America doesn't make anything anymore. America's lost its innovative edge. There's very little research and development being undertaken in America. America has been surpassed by China in research and development. Mm-hmm. And so they're saying, well, we've got to solve that, and we're going to solve that by funding research and development by $1 trillion. Government doesn't solve it. If government was a solution, the military would be effective. If government was a solution, the post office would run effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that government does is inefficient. It's filled with bribery. It's filled with chaos and misappropriation. If you want America to be, or any country to be, inventive, tax them less, remove the restrictions. It's really simple. Allow people to succeed. Government is always the problem. I've been translating for a book that just got finished. It'll probably be available on Amazon by Monday, maybe even tomorrow, which is volume 4 of the Yada Yada series called Invitations. It's on the first 3 Moed Mikra. And one of the things that you find is that God is constantly referencing Mitzrayim and using Mitzrayim as this cesspool, this horrible crucible of religious and political persecution. And one of the things that you find is that in the history of humankind, the larger the institution, the larger the country, the larger the civilization, the worse it is. The more vicious, the more dishonest, the more apt it is to enslave, the more apt it is to impose a caste system. Humankind collectively is a vicious beast. The answer is never more government. Ever. The answer is always less. Always. Individual responsibility, individual accountability is God's view. I've just spent the afternoon translating the real dress rehearsal for Shavuot, which was the revelation of the Torah, as the basis of Judaism is that the 70 elders of Yisrael that are mentioned in the Torah, according to Judaism, they were given the oral law at the same time that Moses was given the written Torah.
Written.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of problems with that. There isn't a Hebrew word for law. And there is, of course, zero evidence of an oral law because the earliest that the rabbis began to compose their Talmud was about 200 BCE, and we're talking about events that took place in 1447 BCE. So they're off by a scant 1,200 years. Moreover, all the people that contributed to the Torah are those that lived primarily at the time of Rabbi Akiva in 133 CE and all the way through 500 CE. The whole concept is preposterous. But when you're listening to Yahweh talk about the revelation of the Torah, it's only Moses. Moshe, full stop. He would say, you know, you can bring up the elders, the 70 elders of the children of Israel, but I'm not going to have anything to do with them. I am not going to extend my hand to them. Can you believe it? God said, I'm not going to even extend my hand to them. They will be here and recognize that I exist, but I'm not going to say a word to them. Why? Because it changes the nature of Judaism. If the rabbis did not know that God exists and that he revealed the Torah to Moshe, then their religion would be manslaughter. But because they know, because God made it clear to them that he existed and that he gave his Torah to Moshe, it's not manslaughter. It's murder. When Moshe went back up the mountain, he didn't even bring Aaron with him. He said that Aram and Tub, which means to dig a hole, and Aaron is the alternative, which is the alternative to dig a hole. He said, you all are going to listen to Satan, Ha-Baal. And you all are associated with one another. You stay here. I don't want any part of you up that mountain. God has a proclivity for something that most people are very uncomfortable with because religions thrive based on popularity. Now, Islam claims to be true because there's lots of Muslims. Christianity was the dominant religion, is still the largest religion in the world. Therefore, it's hard to believe that the religion is nothing but a pile of lies, and though it is. Truth is never popular. And so Yahweh's view is that he really prefers to have a one-on-one conversation. He's really happy with his relationship with Adam. Yahweh wasn't created because God wanted to add another person to his family, but because he wanted to keep Adam entertained, he wanted to support Adam. Now, in all the world, God found Noah and said, you know, you, your wives, your children, their wives, that's enough. I'm not looking for anybody else. You look at Abraham and Sarah, the two of them. That's it. I don't need a tribe. I don't need a clan. I don't need a nation. That'll work just fine. Thank you very much. That's God's style. He would much prefer an intimate, one-on-one, meaningful conversation and relationship than he would with a whole lot of people. He could have met on the top of the mountain with all 600,000 Israelites. He certainly could have included the 70 elders and the four that originally walked up the mountain. But no. With each revelation, was to Moshe alone. That's something that we don't much think about when it comes last week I forgot to mention something. Kamala Harris, which is the only reason that I would prefer that Biden remain senile and not die anytime soon, because she would be worse. She was asked to give the speech at the graduation in the Naval Academy. And just like Obama, she couldn't help it but try to cast her worldview on the U.S. military. You know, with Obama, he tried to recast the government the way the military was run. They have an economic scheme like that. It's called communism. At the top down, everybody follows orders, and you have no free will, no independence. They call that communism. It doesn't work, but that's what Obama wanted. And he would explain his economic policy in terms of the functionality of the military. So she gets there, and she says, I look at you and know that you are among the experts who will navigate and mitigate this threat. What threat? The Chinese? No. The Muslims? Oh, no. The Ruskies? No. You know what threat that she wants them to navigate and mitigate as part of the U.S. Navy?
Turning on us.
Climate change.
Oh, really?
Climate change. She says climate change is the real threat to our national security. You are the ocean engineers who help navigate the ships on thinning ice. You are the mechanical engineers who will help reinforce sinking bases. You are the electrical engineers who will help convert solar and wind energy to power and convert solar and wind energy to combat power. Talk about delusional. One of them is going to do anything about that. And oh, by the way, there's been a comprehensive analysis of the consequence of the world's reaction to climate change and its degradation of the conditions on which the world's poorest live. And the way that we have gone about overreacting to and trying to combat something that we can't have any effect on, climate change, has had a tremendous and negative effect on the poor and the poorest around the world. And it is demonstrable, and yet the elitists that drive this agenda would claim just the opposite. But it is one of the most overreaching problems currently in the third world and with the poorest people is the consequence of the world's reaction to climate change. It isn't climate change. No, it's the stupid policies associated with it. It's like COVID-19. you know, many people die each year of tuberculosis. We didn't shut down the world for it. Many more people die of heart disease and lung disease and diabetes. We don't shut down. But COVID gave liberal politicians the ability to completely undermine freedom, free will, and enterprise, the very things they despise. And they did. And so the problem wasn't COVID-19. The problem was the response to it. Yes, COVID-19 is a real virus. Yes, you should be immunized because you'll live longer, and it's enormously safe. But it doesn't change the fact that everything that we were told about it, virtually everything, is a lie, including the fact that it actually did come out of the Wuhan lab in China. Mm-hmm. The Chinese are eminently responsible for it and lied to the world about it. And the World Health Organization held their hand as they lied to the world about it. And that the consequence in sexual harassment, domestic abuse, suicides, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, antisocial disorders, lack of education and resulting setbacks in terms of the progress of our youth and socialization are staggeringly worse than what the disease itself would have been had we not imposed those restrictions. And that's part of our problem as people. We view things in a vacuum. Oh, wow, if we lock things down, fewer people are going to die. That's not actually true. More people die. It goes back to Saddam Hussein was a really bad guy. We'll take him out of power. It'll be good for Iraq. No, it was worse for Iraq. Why? Because you just can't look at things in a vacuum. What are the other consequences of your actions? And we didn't do that. One of the saddest things today is that science has become so politicized it has lost its credibility. Scientific journals, those who speak on behalf of science, are now so politicized that there really is no credible voice coming out of the sciences. All right, with those things said, I want to return to where we were this time last week. It says, this is from Shemoth names Exodus 6:1. And then Yahweh said to Moshe, the one who draws out, "So now you will see what I will do to show the correct path to the benefits of the relationship with regard to the slave, Pharaoh. For even with his unyielding influence and power," hear her laughing, you know, far in Hebrew, not only means flee, but it also means bull.
That
which is ineffectual and broken. So it's a flea that has got a problem with bull. For even with his unyielding influence and pretense of power, Ba-Yad Shazaz, no matter how powerful he believes he may be, with all the resolve he can muster, he will send them away. And he will drive them out from his land. Well, in the intervening period, the flea used his religious and political power to persecute God's people. His slave drivers became ever more brutal as production quotas were increased. If there were going to be a test between gods and Pharaoh, it was one that Pharaoh thought he could win. I had written here because I was so disappointed with the arrogance of the scholastic community as it relates to the what's called down the standard Egyptian timeline. That there was a book called Test of Time written by David Roll. And we talked about it a little bit at the beginning of this program. David Roll doesn't know you. There's no question about it. And he is criticized in the historical community because he has a different timeline. Here's what I know. His reporting, which is now available online and countless other resources, of what occurred in Goshen, and even what occurred prior to Goshen with Yosef, and Yosef's agrarian reform, his relationship with Pharaoh, the timing of his entering Egypt, the timing of Egypt building storehouses for grain, the 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of drought, and then of following that, of the Israelites being enslaved, of males being killed, of them building edifices in Goshen, all of that is been unearthed and is readily provable. Mm-hmm. And to a large degree, what David Roll did is, and I applaud him for this, he said the classic Egyptian timeline is skewed, elongated, because all of the fleas were liars. All liars. That's one thing you can be assured of when you're reading a record written on behalf of a potentate. You know, I'm constantly reminded when I read what Eusebius had to say about Constantine. It was, his nose was so far up Constantine's tuchus that his eyes were certainly brown. It is just the nature of things, that it was probably worse under the Roman Empire than any other time. And this is the time, that we ought to have had better resources. But during the pharaohs, those who wrote on the inscriptions, they didn't live very long if they told the truth about the pharaoh, because the pharaoh, he had to be a god. He had to, be superlative. So if he reigned for 10 years, well, you better write it down as 15. And everything about him was exaggerated, but most certainly the reigns. And so if you use what they wrote about the timing of the reigns, you're going to have an elongated history because they lied. And they, unfortunately, the Egyptian scholars are enamored with the Egyptian pharaohs. And so they buy into an elongated timeline that really doesn't make any sense. And David Roll did use things like watermarkings on narrow passageways of the Nile to show at the timing of high and low water and use a number of very interesting evidences in Goshen to date all of this. And I was impressed with his reasoning and his evidence. But I recognize that there are a lot of historians that, like Roll, don't buy into the traditional timeline. And one of the more interesting now is how credible are the Amarna letters? We talked about them on a program many, many years ago where you had done some research. I did some research on the Amarna letters, and they actually describe who was Pharaoh, and they describe each of these plagues and the consequence of the plagues and the priest's reaction to each of these plagues. And it's really a remarkable tome written from the perspective of the defeated Egyptians. But, are the Amarna letters trustworthy? I don't know. The Torah is trustworthy. Are the Amarna letters trustworthy? Yeah. I don't know. Is David Roll trustworthy? Maybe, maybe not. Are the Egyptian is the Egyptian standard timeline trustworthy? No. So
Craig, one of the things that makes the Torah so interesting, I don't know of anything, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know of any culture that would tell a story that is so demeaning to them like this story.
Right.
I mean, I mean, it just doesn't happen. And in light of, I agree with you, all these guys are going to lie and they're going to boast about how they conquered everybody and did everything. And these guys are saying, you know, we were slaves. We didn't listen. We went out there and wiped us all out for a next generation. And we came in. We were, and we lost 40 years to the.
All of them have flaws.
Who tells that story?
Look at Adam. You know, she made me do it. And I'm on my fault. She made me do it. Chawa. Oh my God, she names her kids. You know, the enemies of God. Waste of breath. My revenge. I mean, come on. Well, you don't see that kind of stuff. You know, and then you know, you get to Abraham, and he's pimping his wife out for business.
Yeah.
I don't know, dote for all of his magnificence. He's got
every flaw there was.
Oh,
what
a broken family! Oh,
yeah.
So many tragic mistakes. So it's a real story about real people. It is so different than the Egyptian. Now,
any history you'll ever read.
That as we move further in the timeline, and even in more antiquity in the timeline, like Nimrod is a king of Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh names a lot of potentates, and Shinar-Nirab is Nebuchadnezzar. Their name, Cyrus, he's named. And when we read what those kings wrote, and their timing, it ties in, identically with what God said. God did not name the pharaoh. He called him a pharaoh, which is pretty darn amazing, because we wouldn't have known how to pronounce that name until after the Rosetta Stone, and this was written 2,000, almost 3,000, over 3,000 years before the Rosetta Stone. We called him a pharaoh, but didn't name him.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that he was Ramses is utter nonsense. God didn't say that he was a pharaoh.
He was
building Ramses, which is a city dedicated to the sun god Ra. So I think one of the things that I'm pretty comfortable with, because there's just too much evidence of it, that the Exodus occurred in 1447 BCE. One of the things I like about that too, credit Jackie on this. She did some research in terms of days of the week, and you know we've been trying to ascertain when Bukurim occurs. Is Bukurim the day after a natural Shabbat following Matzah, or is Matzah the Shabbat of Shabbat, and it's just a day after Matzah? And in the big fulfillments, Matzah is always a Shabbat. You know, so in 33, for example, when Yahweh, through his soul, is fulfilling Pesach and Matzah and Bukurim, Matzah is a Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? 1447,
Matzah
says Shabbat. Yeah. So, and everything that God says about Matzah is a Shabbat observance. But I'd say that's just one aspect of it. And again, it's not a Yobel year. The timing of it is actually based nothing on the Yobel. Yahweh is telling Abraham, he says, you know, your descendants are going to be slaves in Egypt for 400 years, and then I'm going to bring them out. And if you look at the 40 years they lived in Egypt as guests of the Egyptians for all that Joseph did for them,
mm-hmm.
and then you add that to the 400 years they were slaves, God says, I took them out of Egypt on the very day that I had promised. So it's time to the promise he made to Abraham and tied to 40 plus 400. It's not tied to
a Yobel
or anything else mm-hmm. with that regard. It's tied to his promise, and that 400 is the time of testing. So I can't tell you if Thutmose was the pharaoh of the Exodus or not. God didn't tell mm-hmm. us. I guess it's not all that important. Others say that it was Thutmose that was the pharaoh. That would be Alfred Edersheim that came up with that. Frankly, I don't know. I'm not even sure I care. Man's dead, and he was a nincompoop.
Good answer.
Yeah. As their work multiplied, the Hebrews responded to the added pressure by lashing out at Moshe. Their lack of trust would become epidemic. Yahweh's next statement is comprised of three integrated elements, each of which is controversial. The first contains a bold declaration of Yahweh's name. Since God had already introduced himself to Moshe, there would have been no reason for him to reiterate it this bluntly at this time unless he intended to introduce what follows. But make no mistake, God spoke to Moshe and said to him, "I am Yahweh." He did not say that he was the Lord. He did not validate of the English translations. In the second part of his declaration, Yahweh reemphasizes his relationship with Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob, whose point of connection is that they were recipients of the covenant promises. God not only reveals that he was actually seen by them, something which is considered impossible in rabbinic Judaism, he says that he was Shaddai. Oh, my dog. Goodness gracious. Asher, okay. Calm down. He was Shaddai. It is then odd that Shaddai is universally mistranslated Almighty when it means anything but overwhelming. I think Asher is barking because they're trying to make a delivery. It is 8:08 here and dark. That's the last thing that I want to have to deal with this evening. Then to understand part three of Yahweh's declaration, we must recognize that there are only two words in the next statement which are extant in the Qumran scrolls. Therefore, we cannot be entirely certain that the negation of knowing found in the 11th century CE Masoretic rendering is correct. So there's a lot of things we have to be cognizant of, especially mm-hmm. since the Masoretic intent was to conceal the proper pronunciation of Yahweh. The question as to whether lo, meaning no or not, actually appears in the text was mitigated, however, by the perfect conjugation. It indicates that there was a period of time when Yahweh's name was not known or acknowledged. The inference is then that before Yahweh revealed to them himself to them, they were unaware of his name. This explanation makes perfect sense in this context because Yahweh had made a similar claim, one which Yahweh would resolve through introductions and demonstrations. Unfortunately, I do think I have people outside that are trying to make a delivery. I hope Leia is listening and that she goes out and works with them because I'm not in a position to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And then God, hang on one second. Okay. This is what is stated. Hang on one second. There we go. From
Javier. I'm sure he wants to still go diving. We can't. We're not going to do it tomorrow.
Life goes on. You know, that's just part of
this is
part
a
of
real
living.
Live show. Huh?
It's a real live show, and we have things that happen on a real live show, and you know, and fortunately, you know, we live in a place where it's kind of a paradise, and we. I don't think I've ever been any place where I've had so many friends, and it makes it really special. So there's always somebody here, always somebody that wants to go do something, young, old, in between. And it is such a wonderfully integrated community of different ethnicities and different backgrounds. It's kind of a neat spot. And then God spoke to Moshe. And he said to him, I am Yahweh. I appeared to and was seen by becoming visible to Abraham, to Yitzhak, and to Jacob. As God, Shaddai. But now, Shaddai, that's so different than what we had been led to believe. But what do they say? Shaddai means God Almighty.
Almighty.
It means the opposite of Almighty.
Yeah.
As
always
God
the Shaddai being enough. Yeah.
Yeah. Who was satisfactory and sufficient.
Yeah.
Who was acceptable and reasonable. Who was necessary and enough. Who was adequate. How many times would you feel comfortable saying, yeah, God, he's adequate. He's appropriate.
That's a sales pitch.
Yeah, my God, he's adequate. But it's his word. It's from she, who is, and day, enough. So she means who is, and day means enough.
Enough.
Sufficient, suitable, fitting, appropriate, acceptable, and pleasing. When my name, Yahweh, had not previously been revealed, respected, acknowledged, or understood concerning them. Lo yada. Lahem. Up to this point and time, it had not been shown, known, or discovered by them, or appreciated for its association with them. This is the Nifl perfect with the perfect conjugation in the Nifl stem. There was a point in time before which Yahweh had made his name known and after which it was not well understood. Okay, well, that's interesting. So, Shaddai. It is universally rendered Almighty in English Bibles, is it not?
Oh, yes. No question.
Yeah, Almighty. In English Bibles, even though that rendered cannot be deduced from the words entomology or context, since El means Almighty God, El Shaddai would be like saying Almighty, Almighty. Further, this definition cannot be predicated upon Shad because it means to devastate and destroy, to loot and oppress. That's the opposite of what God accomplished in this
covenant. Don't think that was it, no.
Yeah, but Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob, I don't think that's it. Moreover, vocalized as shed, it would make God a demonic spirit. It's probably not almighty either. On closer inspection, we discover that Shaddai is actually derived from she, a relative pronoun based upon Asher and day, with day can mean the ideas of being satisfactory and sufficient. We find God to be acceptable and reasonable, both adequate and appropriate, even necessary. So rather than bragging, Yahweh is revealing to Moshe that he is reasonable and that he's more than sufficient. Yeah, for Abraham, providing whatever was needed to satisfy the promises to make him acceptable.
Is not shed also the root, the shin and the delete, is breast or mother's milk. I mean, that's everything uh-huh. the child needs. So,
yeah.
It's just not all made. You got it. Yeah.
Adequate and necessary. Right? And it's acceptable.
Yes.
Grade A pasteurized. And because he had done this for Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob, he could be relied upon to do the same for their descendants, the children of Israel. And right at the moment, when you're being pounded by this religious and political regime, someone who was adequate, that's looking pretty appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
So this is to say that God would not be showing off. His intervention would be appropriate and adequate, sufficient to satisfy the promise to free his people. Because of what he said to Abraham, Yahweh would Asher Day show the way to the benefits of the relationship by satisfactorily satisfying his promises, doing whatever was appropriate and necessary. It makes God out to be reasonable and accessible, reliable. He would do enough to rescue them without overwhelming either side, allowing for the maximum expression of free will while still accomplishing the mission. God had just told Moshe that Yahweh is his one and only name, the single and solitary designation by which he wanted to be known. His statement was for all time, for all people, and all places. And that would have included his meetings with Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. There'd be no reason for him to conceal it then or now. Moreover, without stating the alternative moniker, the declaration becomes irrelevant at best and perhaps even conflicting. If he wasn't known as Yahweh to Abraham, then what was he known as?
Father.
Yeah,
Abba.
Doesn't say. Yeah, well, it doesn't say. Mm. And well, no, he wasn't known as Abba to Abraham.
That's right. No.
You read the text, every discussion between Abraham and Yahweh, Yahweh's name is used.
Yes.
Exclusively, no other name. So.
Now, why is that missed so obvious? I mean, I highlighted that when I was reading. You know, Yahweh is his one and only name, and I know that.
For all time,
because
for all
people.
We've
been doing it forever. That, yeah, absolutely. And we would have no reason for him to conceal it then or now. That should be so obvious.
Yeah, and Yahweh is the only person who could have told Moshe, and therefore who could have told us, about his relationship with Abraham. Abraham is wholly unknown apart from Yahweh's description of that relationship to Moshe.
Right.
And so with Moshe, he says Yahweh, 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 and nothing else. So, clearly we're done.
Good
by
clue.
Yeah. By the way, you know, I was talking about just Moshe was going up to receive the Torah.
Right.
Who wrote actually scribed the Torah?
Well, I assume that Moshe was taking dictation. Is that not correct?
That's what I always assumed. But that's not what the text actually says. It says that Yahweh wrote the tablets, the Torah, and the mitzvah, the terms and conditions of the covenant. And that he wrote the tablets, the Torah, and the mitzvah, the conditions of the covenant, to teach his people, the Yahweh them. But it says that Yahweh wrote them. So I had always thought that Moshe took dictation.
Yeah,
I don't think that says that, you know, there are places, I'm sure, that Moshe wrote a copy of what Yahweh said. And I think it's very much like Yahweh's instructions to kings. If you're going to lead my people, write a copy of the Torah. I've been writing the Torah now for 20 years. And I can tell you that one of the best ways to learn something is to write it.
Write about it. Yeah.
Right? So writing it would have reinforced Moshe's understanding and his ability to recall what God had said. So there's likely a copy of the Torah written in Moshe's hand. But there's also a copy of the Torah written by
Yahweh himself.
Yeah, and that takes it to another level because Yahweh would not have written the Torah.
There is no scribal error.
on a piece of parchment.
Yeah.
Would have done it on a piece of parchment. You know, he's not going to sit there with a dead animal up there in heaven. And so he didn't write on a piece of parchment. It was a scroll. And it's in his penmanship. He wrote it. Can you imagine what that thing looks like?
Well, I'm curious what the alphabet that he used looked like.
Yeah, I know you would love, and so would I.
Yeah, I would love to see it. Wow, what a...
And that pictographic Paleo Hebrew. Yeah, we would both love to.
Cool.
Yeah, love to see it that way, but I don't think that's well. I think we will.
I don't know
because it says a lot of things. One of the things that it says is that the original autograph exists, not only exists, but is as legible, as brilliant, and as perfect as it ever was. The original autograph, if God wrote it, he said he did, would not have deteriorated.
No, couldn't.
No.
Just won't. Put it that way, just won't.
Yeah, so
he knows how to do
and,
this.
And it also suggests something else that I hadn't thought of too, which is that since God said that he wrote it, that means the material that it's on and the way the words are inscribed in that material makes it very easy for God just to plug it into us when he comes to reaffirm his covenant with Yisrael and Yehudah at the cusp of his return in 2033. And now it is a program, really, that he could incorporate right into us. Although I don't think it's going to be the existing Torah, but Torah 2.0.
Well, that actually makes a lot of sense. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
The question then begs the question, why?
Yeah.
With all
yeah,
that stuff
I,
in it that we don't need.
Yeah, there's so much stuff in the Torah. Like Yahweh's dealings with Pharaoh. And... Or even going back prior to that, if you're dealing with the way the children of Israel responded to Moshe's attempt to save them, it's not appealing. The plagues are not appealing. Why would you want to know about the plagues in eternity? Or why would you want to know about the flood, something that frustrated God, that made him this very sad? Why would you want to know about that in eternity? Why would you want to know
dwell
in eternity?
Who wants to dwell on that?
Yeah, why would you want to know in eternity that Abraham, not once but twice, tempted out his wife for material goods? You know, the relationship turned out great, but man, it had some serious warts along the way. Why would you want to know that? Why would you want to know when Dod is our shepherd and is leading us, why would you want to know that he made some really bad decisions and had all of this family strife? You know, so I might realize that's not in the Torah per se, but I think there's Torah throughout the prophets, and there's prophecy throughout the Torah. I think it's just all one testimony. I just think that God's Torah will be his teaching, direction, guidance, and instructions for how to capitalize and enjoy and survive and thrive in six and seven dimensions. The fact that he has written it would indicate that he's written it all, including what he's going to give to us. So without stating the alternative moniker, the declaration that he was known by some different name perhaps becomes irrelevant at best and perhaps even conflicting. Then a contradiction would exist because Yahweh's name was presented frequently throughout the narratives with Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. Therefore, in this context, with Yada written in the finite perspective, of the perfect conjugation, I'm comfortable with the preceding rendering, which was there was a period of time, now over, that God was not known by Yahweh. And it could also suggest that thereafter there was a period of time, a finite period of time, when Yahweh's name was not understood. And clearly today, apart from our research, our study of the Torah, Yahweh's name is not well understood.
No, it's pathetic.
It's how little it is
known.
Correct. And how easy it is to deduce from the text. And in addition, I established at that moment in time my covenant with them to approach and to give them the land associated with Canaan, to subdue, to subjugate, and to humble. In association with this land, they remained as immigrants to show the way to the benefits of the relationship, dwelling as a guest within it. Therefore, I heard the painful suffering and groaning of the children of Yisrael, whom the Mitzrayim, those in the crucibles of political and religious oppression, had chosen to work as slaves. Concerning them, I remembered my covenant relationship. And that's what this is really all about, is the covenant. Mm-hmm. Yahweh made a promise to Abraham. He said, this is what's going to happen to your descendants. But I'm going to rescue them. I will liberate them. And it will happen in exactly this many years. And that's part of it, the big part of it. God made a promise. He honors his promises. That's important because God's made a promise to lengthen our days, to perfect us, to adopt us, to enrich and empower us so that he can reconcile his relationship with us and we can live with him forever. So the very fact that he honors his relationships is important. But there's something far more about all of this, which is if God did not liberate the children of Israel, there would have been no Torah.
Yeah, who would have written it? I mean, who would have been given it to?
Right.
Who would have given it to?
No context, right. No context.
Yeah.
You just can't give it to one person and have them, you know, flail it around in the air. Not going to do any good. It had to be manifest and through a people group. And to see how it prevailed for them when they paid attention to it and how they failed when they ignored it. And so without the children of Israel.
He had to wait that long. He had to wait that long to get enough crowd to make an impact. And even then.
Well, that's,
that's
certainly part of it. The other part of it is that he had made a specific time commitment, and he knew how he wanted history to play out over 6,000 years, too. And so it was all laid out. But the children of Israel had to be freed, because if they were not freed, there was no one else, because he formed this relationship with Abraham, who gave birth to Yishak, who gave birth to Jacob, who became Israel. It's these people. He formed the covenant relationship, and the Torah exists to convey the covenant. In fact, the very first time that the Torah is mentioned in association with Moshe and during the Yatza Exodus, in the first sentence, Yahweh says that the Torah is it's the Torah of the covenant. So the Torah exists to present, to introduce, to explain the covenant. So as the father of the covenant, it is Yahweh's responsibility to protect his children. Told Abraham he would do so, which is why he was having this discussion with Moshe. They could rely upon him then, just as Israel can trust him today. But let's be clear. Yahweh, not Jesus, not Allah, is offering to save Israel. Not Egyptians, not Greeks, not Romans, not Christians, not Muslims, nor Pakistanians. If we want to participate, we have to join Israel, not oppose them. Every bit of this is devoted to and predicated upon the deliverance and salvation, the withdrawal from religious and political oppression of the children of Israel. No one else is mentioned. As we go through time and Yahweh wants to reconcile his relationship prior to his return, it's with Israel and Yehuda. No one else is mentioned.
Wow.
Yeah.
We know this already, but I mean, this is all news to us, but I mean, come on. Now.
Yeah. Everyone that wants to believe that God changed teams, that he went from Jews to Arabs, as Islam would claim, or he went from Jews to Goyim Christians, as Paul would claim, are completely inconsistent with God's message, which means they lie. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, don't say to the Romans, don't say to the Egyptians, don't say to the Babylonians or the Assyrians, don't say to the Christians or the Muslim, say to the children of Israel, Bene Israel, I am Yahweh. I'm not Hashem. I'm not the Lord. I am Yahweh. And I will bring you out.
What's hard about that? Yeah.
Why Yatsa Eth Atem? Atem is the plural of you. Eth means with. Yatsa means to withdraw, to remove, to bring out.
Yeah.
I will descend and lead you out and serve to deliver you from under the burdens of forced labor and compulsory service of religious and political oppressors. Mitzrayim. Yatsa is the actual word that we should have been using to describe the Exodus.
Yes.
Now, the book of Exodus is not Exodus. It is Shemot names. Oh, pretty good name. Mentioned in the midst of it, that would be Yahweh's name. Israel is an important name in the midst of it. Mitzrayim is actually an important name on the negative side. But the Exodus itself is a Yatsa. If we're going to apply titles to the things that God does, we ought not apply a Greek title. God didn't speak Greek. And God called the Greeks a beast. He didn't speak Latin. He called the Romans a beast. He spoke Hebrew. The Hebrew word that is convoluted into Exodus is Yatsa. We ought to know it. And the reason we ought to know it is what Yahweh was withdrawing and removing his people from. The Yatsa is always from Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is the thing that God opposes the most. It is the thing that is most dangerous and destructive to his people. Mitzrayim is religion and politics and militarism and economics on a national or institutional scale.
So you're back to the opening remarks. That's exactly what you said to start. Yeah.
It is so essential that we stop using Exodus apart from Yatsa, and that we understand that Yatsa means to remove, to withdraw, to bring out. And we're not being brought out from Egypt, being brought out from Mitzrayim.
From a system, yeah.
Right. The cauldrons of persecution.
Yeah.
Yeah, the crucibles of oppression. This is the place, and God was so clear on what he hated there, the place of religion and politics and economic schemes and militarism and conspiracy. It is what man does when man gets together in large institutions. The larger the institution, the worse man becomes. Mitzrayim is what matzah was designed to cure.
And so clear.
Yeah, and I will bring you out. I will yatsa you from under the burdens of forced labor and compulsory service of the religious and political oppressors, Mitzrayim, the cauldrons of military and economic subjugation, the coercive cruelty experienced in Egypt where you were confined and restricted by political persecution, considered to be a foe and besieged and assaulted, shut up as if inside of a concentration camp. That might sound too extreme to say shut up inside of a concentration camp, but Mitzrayim is the plural of Matsur, and Matsur is based on Sur, and Sur means to shut up, to constrict, mm-hmm. to constrain, to torment and abuse. It's as much as words will allow to describe what it would be like to live in a concentration camp.
Yeah.
You're concentrated into a highly troubling environment. That's what Mitzrayim means. I will deliver you, rescuing you, defending you, saving you. Wa natsal et atem. I will remove you and save you, protecting and sparing you from being enslaved to them. And I will redeem you. Wa ga'al atem et atem. I will ransom you, paying the price to free you with the sacrificial lamb and the productive arm shepherding the flock. I will redeem you with the Zeruah.
Interesting.
The prevailing and effective nature, the strength, the resolve, the overall ability of this remarkably important and impactful individual of action, who as a leader and fighter is engaged as a shepherd among the sheep, who is fruitful in this way, is accomplishing the mission, especially when sowing the seeds of truth, while denoting and advancing the purpose of the arm of God and the fifth shepherd and sacrificial lamb. All engaged and extended, along with many important decisions and extraordinary judgments, Shabbat. We can take credit for ascertaining many, many hundreds of insights, maybe thousands, that Yahweh placed in his words for us to find. One of them, and I think among the more important of them, is Zeruah.
Mm-hmm.
In English Bibles, it is written as arms. And could you deduce arms from maybe 10% of the translations? Yeah, maybe. But, I don't know. Not likely. Zeruah, is, the root of Zeruah is pretty straightforward. Zera. I mean, there's nothing hidden about that, is there? I mean, did you look up Zeruah?
Hmm.
Obviously
I got
based
the same
on
thing.
Zera.
Yeah. So I got pretty much the same things that you did on each one. But it's also, I mean, I can do the letters too. If you've got you're cutting a path, you know, with a plow,
right.
To a head that's facing the right direction is observing, and then the for increase, and I can't remember the last one.
Well, you got erosion
was
there.
Was that a native? Yeah.
And you got a
that's the head, observing. That's the observing head.
Yeah, and then the left, the round.
Yeah,
the round. Yeah, well, you've got the ram because it is the sacrificial lamb. When Zoroa is first introduced in the Torah, Yahweh is describing how the Kohen are to prepare the Pesach lamb. So the Zoroa is the sacrificial lamb of Pesach as it is described and introduced in the Torah. So that's pretty straightforward. So it's really hard to counteract that. But there are three Zoroa. Obviously, one of the three Zoroa is leading the children of Yisrael out of Gaza, removing them from Mitzrayim. That Zoroa would be Moshe.
Yeah, Moshe, of course. Yeah.
Right. And there are other places in the Torah where it just flat out says Moshe is a Zoroa. Well, there's other places that say that Dod is a Zoroa.
Correct.
Someone
has to interpret all the
and really important Zoroa. And then, while there is no place that actually says Yahusha is a Zoroa, because there is no prophecy that actually says Yahusha is anything, the presentation of Yahusha's role as the sacrificial lamb make him the epitome of a Zoroa.
Yeah.
Plus the most,
the
most demonstrative prophecy on Yahusha's purpose as the Pesach Gael, as the Passover lamb, is Yahshua Isaiah 53. It opens by saying, who is it that came to understand who the Zoroa are? And so it's obviously, since it's talking about Yahusha, the Passover lamb, one of those Zoroa is Yahusha. One is Dod. One is Moshe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's Moshe. Yeah.
Yeah. One is the leader who is shepherding the flock, leading them away from Mitzrayim. That Zoroa is Moshe. The other Zoroa is that protective strong arm of God protecting the people. That is Dod. And the sacrificial lamb is Yahusha. They all sowed the seeds of life. And Zera means to sow, which is to plant something that you expect to root and to grow and to bear fruit. So Zera is a really powerful term, and it also means offspring. So you're planting the seeds that you expect to grow with the fruit of those seeds being children of the covenant, offspring. So the word itself, Zoroa, is a powerful word, and to render it as just one thing is sad, particularly when, I was dealing with a passage that was clearly talking about Dod and called him a Zoroa, and he was not a sacrificial lamb. He was the shepherd. Yahusha was the lamb. And then you realize, who did a better job, a more prolific job of sowing the seeds that would take root and create the
who
covenants?
Who told us about Yahusha?
Children, offspring.
Who told us about the event?
Dod and Yahusha.
22nd Psalm. Yeah,
Dod and
without them, you got to have all three to complete the package no matter what you do.
Correct. You need the Torah. That is the Zoroa of Moshe. You need the firstborn of the covenant. You need the shepherd. You need the Masiach, the Son of God. That is the author of the Mizmor, the Psalms, and the Mashal Proverbs. That's Dod.
Mm-hmm.
He is the firstborn of this covenant relationship. And then you need the sacrificial lamb, Yahusha.
Yeah.
They are the three Zoroa. By the way, one of the things that I'm talking about, Yahusha, here is that we have to be a bit careful with Yahusha because there's a reason for two things. One is that even though the role that was played by the Passover lamb was exceedingly important to our long longevity, responsible for our ability to prolong our days. There isn't a single prophecy that names Yosha, not one. So why would God have somebody this important and not have a single prophecy where his name? You know, Dode is named in over 1,000 prophecies. Moshe's name is second only to Dode's and Yahweh's in prevalence in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Yosha is non-existent. I mean, there are 220 references to Yosha, with 200 of them being to Yosha ben Nun, and the others just to miscellaneous people named Yosha over time. Not one to Yosha as the Passover lamb. Well, there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that, and that is, Yosha isn't a name. It's a job description. It's a mission statement. Yeah. Yahweh was saying, I am the one who delivers, who liberates, who is saving you. It's Yahweh doing it. Why?
Yeah.
Because the soul of Yosha
is
Yahweh's. When Yahweh told Abraham, I will provide the lamb, he was the lamb. It was his soul. His soul experienced all of the ruthlessness of the Romans. His soul. His soul that fulfilled matzah. And the set-apart spirit that took his soul from Pesach to Sheol on matzah and then released his soul on Bukurim.
Yeah,
so,
I'll always remember the time you and I and JB, and we were discussing who's coming back, and it's Yahweh was coming back, and he's not coming back with what you say, mini me. That one is that rest.
No, yeah, he's not coming back with mini me. You know, and realistically, we have to be again careful to recognize that the role that the Passover lamb is enormously important. But the name of the Passover lamb is not. The mission statement of the Passover lamb is exceedingly important. And the name of the Passover lamb is only important is if you know it as Yahweh saving.
And then it was done.
Now, the other thing is that we don't have a single word that Yosha spoke in the language he spoke yet.
It's been reliably
maintained. Not one. And with Moshe, what do we have? We've got all of his conversations with Yahweh and the first four books of the Torah. And then we have Devarim, this magnificent treasure of Moshe's explanations and presentation of the Torah in words. I mean, we have words for Moshe. And the only thing that there is more of than Devarim in the Dead Sea Scrolls is Dode's Mizmor. And so with Dode, we have more words that were spoken of him and written by him than anyone else who was related to Yah, by far. And so they are one and two. And it's then the third Zeroah is the Yahweh himself saving us when we consider that Yosha had Yahweh's soul. Now, we will get to this as we move through these books, but to you and me, Kirk, and to everyone who is listening, our soul is the totality of who we are. Our bodies are so irrelevant to who we are. Yeah, sometimes they have aches and pains, and so that part matters to us, and who we are physically matters to our loved ones, but we are really our soul, and it is our soul that is the repository of our personality, of our attributes, of our attitudes, of our memories, of our personalities. It's all encapsulated in our soul. And so our soul is the essence of who we are. With Yahweh, he has a soul, but his soul is more like we as humans would send the Perseverance rover to Mars.
Yeah.
The Perseverance rover to Mars extends our reach, right? It gives us the opportunity to hear, to even smell, to see, to feel what it's like to be on Mars. We can move on Mars. We can fly on Mars. We can roll on Mars. We can dig on Mars. We can hear the wind blow on Mars. We can see what it's like to be there. We can feel what it's like to be there. That rover,
you experience it all.
Is a very sophisticated probe that extends our reach and experience so that we can experience what it's like to be on Mars. Now, if you were to take the best probe in human development, would probably be the rover Perseverance, and magnify that by billions of billions of times, Yahweh's nephesh soul would be that sort of thing, where it conveyed Yahweh's personality and Yahweh's, you know, some of his intellect and his attributes and his attitudes. It's one of the things that I like is that we know in reading the Torah, that given the choice between lots of people and one person, two people or 2 million people, 8 people or 8,000 people, Yahweh always chose the smaller number. He's a bit of an introvert. He likes one-on-one conversations, one-on-one relationships, and our small groups of families. And you look at what we know of Yosha, a bit of a recluse. You know, he'd give the Sermon on the Mount and be, okay, I'm going to be here at the top. I'll give my sermon. You all sit down there. And what did he do afterwards? Disappear. He would, meet with a few people, say a few things.
Then run away.
Yeah.
Get on the boat and get over. Get out of the way. Cross the lake.
Yeah, absolutely. So it conveys that same kind of personality. And God's snarky. Yeah. I'm here translating, trying to figure out, you know, what God's deal is with the elders of Israel. And it says, you know, I didn't even extend my hand towards them. I mean, wow.
Yeah,
and then he says, listen, I want to make a special point of this. I'm leaving Aaron, which is the alternative, who has now the free will, also Aaron, and Jor, which means to dig a hole, with the elders who have decided that they're going to stay down here, over here.
Yeah.
And they're going to listen to the Lord Baal. And what they do, just keep it to yourself. And what did they do? They built the damn golden calf. That's snarky. It's got a really interesting personality and all of this. I happen to really, I like it. I just think it's marvelous. So anyway, he says, I'm going to redeem you. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I see in it also that he's quite more excited about lifting the other two Zoroas up. You know, he doesn't need any acclaim. He does what he has to do. He did.
Yeah.
He's doing the lifting for the family.
There is one
lifted.
Bit of acclaim that he wants. Listen, he is clearly saying that that Moshe is a Zoroa. He's the strong arm of God. He is the protective shepherd. He is the one who is sowing the seeds that are going to take root and grow and be fruitful. He is all over giving. And listen, Moshe is spectacular. I mean, Moshe is a man's man. That guy's got character. He's got fortitude. God fell in love with Moshe. Oh, there's no way. Yeah, you can figure out why God wanted Moshe to do this. Moshe is a great guy. He just spectacular human being. Maybe the best of us who have ever been. And with Dode, of course, God's law. I even lost his perspective on Dode. To be fair, I mean, God's so in love with Dode. You know, Dode's his firstborn, is his chosen one, the Messiah, Son of God, the branch, the shepherd, the King of Kings, King. Coming back. Yeah. He's more glorious than the sun. I mean, God loves
overboard.
Dode.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, every doting father goes, you know, a little bit overboard.
That's
when describing the attributes of my boy. And God does this with Dode. That's his boy. And so the ultimate Zoroa is, of course, Dode. The one place where he is really serious, though, about crediting Yahusha, who is Yahweh saving us, as a Zoroa, is God made the promise to Abraham, I will provide the lamb.
I will provide the lamb, right.
He did. And that's why that's Zoroa, as Yahweh saving us, is important, and why Yahweh's taking credit for it, and why Yahshua 53 begins by saying, you know, you want to understand this? Yeah, well, there is somebody out there that figured out who the three Zoroa is. You may want to listen to his rendering and take on what follows, because it's not consistent with what you're getting from any religious institution, and it is consistent with my message. So Zoroa is a very important term. Moshe here is being called a Zoroa. So I'm going to redeem you. And redeem is an interesting thing. I'm going to ransom you, paying the price to free you with the sacrificial lamb, with the productive arm and shepherding the flock. So he's talking about Pesach, the first Pesach, and the fulfillment of Pesach here too.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about Moshe as a shepherd, his people as a flock. Engaged in extended Netzach, along with many important decisions and extraordinary judgments. Shabbat Gadol, enabling verdicts, acquittals, and condemnations. Now, it is the purpose of the Talmud and the New Testament to hoodwink the unthinking into believing God has established a set of laws that the religious must obey to win faith.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing could be further from the truth. Yahweh's a liberator. He's not an authoritarian despot. He's committed to freeing us from religious oppression, not subjecting us to it. That is why, if you want to understand the Torah, understand Yatzah Mitzrayim. Just understand Yatzah Mitzrayim. Yahweh's here to free us from religion. He's not here to subject us to religion. He's not wanting to have us obey him. He wants us to be liberated so we can choose to love him.
The one thing you can't argue is free will. Then once you understand it's free will, everything should fall into place, because then you have no argument. You can't be law. You can't be coerced. He can urge. He can plead. He can say, go do this, Moshe.
Yep. You know, I heard Leah loves these documentaries. Come here and visit. You're going to hear Leah's document. She loves documentaries. And so she subjected me to a documentary a couple of nights ago, and it was two of the most acclaimed scientists in the world today, and they were having a discussion on what represents consciousness. And these guys were absolutely clueless. They got everything wrong. They just mumbled back and forth, and seems to me, it seems to me, it seems to me. They had nothing but opinions, and their opinions were ill-fated. The fact of the matter, if you don't know Yahweh, you've got no idea as to what consciousness is. You don't understand what a nefesh soul is and what it represents. So then she starts my day out today. Well, actually, I was here since like 5:30 doing translations. But she comes in and she says, I want you to watch another documentary. And this was two of the most brilliant minds. Just two astonishingly brilliant people. Fortunately, neither one knows Yahweh. But nonetheless, they were brilliant. They were talking about being judgmental. And they were, their unified conclusion is that if you're not judgmental, you have no purpose of free will. Free will only matters
right.
if you're judgmental. And if
right.
you're part of this cancel culture and political correctness, telling people they should not be judgmental, that is a judgment. And you're just nothing but a hypocrite.
Yeah.
But it was just so interesting. And one of the things that, that one of the scientists said is that if you want a correlation between success and failure in this regard, that one of the things that is highly determinant as to whether a person is going to be successful is their conscience. Not consciousness,
mm-hmm.
but conscience. Does this person have character? Do they know the difference between right and wrong? Will they make a stand to do the right thing for no other reason than it's the right thing to do?
Yeah. Do the right thing.
Conscience.
Yeah.
They didn't know the word nesama, but nesama is our conscience, where nefesh is our consciousness. And they were talking about in psychological studies, there are three things that determine whether or not a young man or woman is going to be successful in life. And those three
mm-hmm.
things are conscience, the nesama, whether you are able to use it or not, whether you are judgmental in a rational and reasonable manner where you're going to be responsible and accountable and are committed to doing the right thing. Conscience.
Okay.
The second, and this is not in this order, is intellect. He said if you are in between 1 and 3 deviations born, 1 to 3 deviations born into a family that is wealthier than the norm by the standard deviation of 1, 2, or 3, or you're born with an intelligence that is 1, 2, or 3 standard deviations from norm. By the time you're 40, the person who is smarter will have much greater success than the person who was born into wealth. So this idea that wealth is passed on, no, intelligence that really matters. And the third is you need to be a child of a committed relationship where one of the two parents is a man. Though their evidence is overwhelming. That does not in any way diminish the role that mothers play, and it is huge, and no man can fulfill that role. It just says in success of life, the mother's going to keep you alive and going to show you love. But if you're going to be successful in life, you need a father.
Yeah.
You just have to have a positive, committed male role model in your life.
Well, there's a reason there's two Hayes and Yao's name.
That's exactly
family
right.
Family unit.
Yeah, so right. There's a reason that Yahweh presents himself as our Heavenly Father and spiritual mother.
And
throughout
and
the presentation of the Mikra, he uses Malacha. And in Bible translations, they tried to hide the fact that they call it work. You know,
mm-hmm.
There's two words they think that mean work. But Malacha is not based on a Hebrew word for work. Maaseh is a Hebrew word for work. Ashah is a Hebrew word for work. Labanah is a Hebrew word for work. The Malacha is not. Malacha is the feminine of Malach. Malach is a male messenger. Malacha is a female messenger.
Mm-hmm.
The Malach are mostly associated with the heavenly hosts, with the Yahweh's spiritual implements and heavenly representatives. Malacha, therefore, would be a feminine, maternal messenger, so a spiritual counselor and maternal messenger. And the a Ruach Kodesh, of course. Although there are men who are Malach and women who can be Malacha, because God's message is there for us to convey, and when we're conveying it, we are messengers. So, but Malacha permeates it, and so when you're looking at the covenant and the Mikre, which enable us to get there, there's always a mother and father. If you read Dodd's Bashal, his Proverbs, almost all of them are written from the perspective of a mother and father guiding the child. The mother is the Ruach Kodesh, the set-apart spirit. The father is Yahweh. And the son is Dodd.
Yeah, I was going to say Dodd.
So,
yeah,
they're
overwhelming.
That's God's idea. That is what works.
That's your plan.
In terms of raising our family. When we raise our family, we model after his family, we will have greater success. Now, that is not to say we won't have broken families.
No.
Dodd's family was shattered. Abraham's family was to some degree shattered. Yahweh's family is the epitome of shattered. So it's not to say that we're going to have nothing but rose petals and butterflies. It's well, life is tough. Families are challenging.
Nobody said it'd be easy.
Highly rewarding, but also enormously frustrating. So that's God's perspective. So as we end here, God is saying, "I will redeem you with the Zeruah, along with many important and extraordinary judgments." With judgments being Shaphat. Shaphat means to decide. So they're going to be really wonderful means to decide, to make a good decision, to differentiate between right and wrong, you know, to exercise good judgment, Shaphat. And today I think it's one of the things that's the most lacking in our world is people exercising good judgment, people making a conscious decision between what is right and wrong. It's so bad.
Go along to get along. Yeah.
Yeah, that they cancel culture and political correctness would insist that you accept that which is not true and that you reject that which is true. Now, we talk about how so much of this now is this myth that that African Americans have somehow been mistreated and that they're plight is because Caucasians have held them down. And it's wholly untrue, but if you say it's untrue, your voice is
drowned out.
Yeah, is drowned out in silence. And yet, as I said, I was listening to this documentary, this interview, and everything that I've said has been validated. Mm-hmm. That if you're going to resolve the problems in the community, which need to be resolved, you have to start with the fact their families, well, they are no families. That men are not men, they're not fathers. And the children grow up to repeat the cycle, and that the women without men in their lives are way too aggressive. They're way too prone to abuse their own children. And then we have created this culture that has thrown money at a problem, rewarding not only failure, but encouraging more children to be born out of a committed relation.
Have more children, have no father, more money.
Right. And then to try to blame everyone except hold the people accountable that are actually responsible for the problem.
Yeah.
And that's a society losing the ability to exercise good judgment. And boy, do we need that.
Well, I was going to share one quick thing with you. This week I turned on the History Channel, and I couldn't believe it. They did a whole series on World War I, which lines up so well. I've always been a little concerned about why it took off so much. I know there's alignment of this country with this country, and when they shot that Yugoslavian prince or the Austrian, everything started snowballing. But it explained it so well. It was amazing. And I can't help but see where we're going now with our alignment with Russia and China and Iran and how the Europe and us is coming down the same way. And there was a...
Go ahead. Finish your thought, then I'm going to add something on his.
Okay, there was just one. There was one other one that kind of blew me away. It was the they showed this whole show on the Mufti going to Germany and pictures of him and with him and doing everything of him planning the final solution, and then back after the end of the war, he recruited all the colonels and all these people that were not in Nuremberg trials and got them down there, and they literally started training the Muslims in Israel to fight against the Yehudim. It was just everything you talked about.
Yeah,
I know it's,
you know,
it's
interesting
written,
that
but
this
you just
is
don't
the,
see it on, you just don't see it on TV.
Yeah, this is the anniversary. In fact, I think it's today, either today or yesterday, of one of the worst episodes of Muslims being Muslims and their hatred of Jews and being out of control. Mm-hmm. I was in Baghdad, where in 1941 there was a conservative group of Muslims that rose to power, and as they rose to power, they thought that they would, just like Hamas, that they would win favor by telling fellow Muslims to go out and rape and rob and murder Jews. And mm-hmm. there were some 600 to 700 Jews that were murdered, countless that were women that were raped, thousands of businesses and homes that were plundered by out-of-control Muslims. And finally, when it was all over, there was only one opportunity for the Jews, who had been there for thousands of years, and that was they had to leave with nothing. Mm-hmm. They were pushed out. They had to leave their possessions. They had to leave their land. They had to leave their businesses after having been raped and murdered. And then you have, you know, these Muslims as the fakestinians in Israel, demanding that that they get everything imaginable for the
reparations
from the Jews. And the reality is that Muslims for the 1,400 years that Islam has existed have been savages, and that they have treated Jews as badly as any group of people have ever treated another. And now to call the Jews terrorists as
the
absolute dunderheads on the left are doing shows a complete ignorance of history and the forces at play. Speaking of the forces at play, Netanyahu is, I understand, was finally ousted as prime minister of Israel, longest-serving prime minister.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of me is sad in the sense that Netanyahu did a nice job of standing up against Islamic terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
He did a nice job of standing up against the Iranian threat to go nuclear and destroy Israel. He did a nice job of getting more settlements throughout Israel to get the U.S. capital moved into Jerusalem. And so for Israel to throw out a politician who has done that much for his country and his people, probably more than any Jewish leader in history, it just speaks of the lack of judgment of Jews today. Now, there's a part of me, though, that is thrilled that he is gone, because his power base was largely the religious party.
Oh, the combination
party.
With the religious,
right.
Religious group.
They,
yeah,
without
absolutely.
The Haredi, he's not prime minister. And these are amongst the worst people in the world. They just are. That Ultra-Orthodox Jews are among, are probably the people God detests most in the world. And now they're having a conniption fit today because one of the fundamental purposes of the of this coalition to oust Netanyahu was to break with the support of the religious parties, that the religious parties don't work, they don't pay taxes, they get stipends to be religious, they don't support the faith, they don't engage, and the IDF, they're just total waste of lives, and state-supported waste of lives. And so the coalition says, no, we're not going to do that anymore. We need to reduce the role of religion in government. And so the rabbis are having a conniption. Oh, God forbid, God, you know, I need God-fearing person. Religion is the core of who we are. And absolute malarkey. So it is good to see that because unless there is a clean distinction between what it is to be a Jew and Judaism, it's going to be very difficult for any material number of Yehudim and Yisraelites to return to Yahweh. Because to return to Yahweh and to be part of the reconciliation on the day of reconciliation, you're going to have to completely disown any connection to Judaism and also to Israeli politics. You can support Israel without being political. And so this divide now, this very sharp divide that's going to take place post-Netanyahu between the rabbis who want to control everyone's lives and who want to make Judaism and being a Jew synonymous, and the this coalition that says, no, being Jewish is an ethnicity. We're part of a country, and most of us are not ultra-Orthodox. In fact, 80% of us are not. And so I think that is an exceedingly positive move. And I think that, that you know, the degradation of freedoms in the world and the degradation of the economy in the world that is the stupidity of the reaction to COVID and the stupidity of the reaction to climate change and the stupidity of the current administration in Washington, that those things are going to expedite our decline such that the timing of Yah's return is certainly looking imminent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And particularly this big move in Israel because there had to be a divide, a sharp divide between the ultra-Orthodox who wish to control every aspect of Jewish life and Israel as a nation and Jews as people. So we're seeing all of that take place. We're also seeing a greater influx of Jews to Israel than ever before. And that's particularly remarkable with all the Hamas rockets, with all the negative,
yeah, you would think it would be a absolutely no-go zone.
Yes, but it's the I think that the that while blacks are making noise for claiming to be the victims of racism, which clearly existed in some parts of the country, major parts of the South, for a very long time and was clearly wrong, they are not racially abused to near the extent that Jews are, and that anti-Semitism is grossly underreported in the world right now, and it is a worldwide phenomenon growing exponentially, and it is something we ought to expect to get worse, which can be the silver lining in this dark cloud, which is the it's time for Yehudim and for Yisraelites to return to Yahweh. Your rabbis have lied to you. You know, you've tried one approach now for a better part of 3,000 years. It has not worked. Mm-hmm. You know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome. If you want to know what works, read about Dode, read about Hezekiah. Read about Noah. And you'll find out what works. Try it.
Yeah.
All right? That's
well,
what works.
Well,
what you're doing doesn't work. So the our hope is that more and more Yehudim listen. One thing I want to leave you with is that several people have, first of all, a large team of people have worked with me to now create, I think it's now 16 volumes of Yada Yada. And they are so much richer, so much more accurate, so much more insightful, so much better than they were previously. And Jackie in particular, but her entire edit team. Mike has done a marvelous job. JK has done a marvelous, marvelous job. Molly has done a marvelous job. But Jackie has been extraordinary in this, and we really now have some spectacular books that we can be proud of that do the job of the Nesh the way that Yahweh intended.
Mm-hmm.
But
I looked on your website before the show. It was really beautiful. David
and Scott,
yeah.
Particularly David, working with mm-hmm. Jackie, have created a website. It's at Yada Yada.
Oh, okay.
Let me see if I could get you the exact URL, because it is absolutely beautiful the way that this website presents the material. It's Yada Yada, Y-A-D-A-Y-A-H dot David's, D-A-V-I-D-S, G-O-D, davidsgod.com.
Yeah.
We're going to eventually link to it directly from yadaya.com and yadayawa.com. But right now it is yadaya.davidsgod.com. And what you'll find all of the books, including now Covenant, which Invitations, which has just come out, are all presented on a bookshelf. You can click on any one of these books, and they're right there before you. They'll open up as you click on any one of these spines. You can go and listen to archives. You can search the books in many different ways. You can go to the community of the various sites that are supporting the books. It's all there for us, and it is it's a beautiful presentation. And it opens with the prelude to the first volume of Yada Yahweh, which is begins. We're embarking on life's greatest adventure and take us a place mm-hmm. that few have experienced. Yeah, and it has the Lion of Judah sitting there. It's a beautiful presentation. I think it's the and we've gone so long without having enough
data. That's well done. It's really yes. Gosh, it's
yeah.
pretty.
So yeah. That is where we are on that, and I want to thank all of them for their work.
here.
Many thousands of pages of new material, and it's exciting. So thank you, one and all. Happy Shabbat. We'll look forward to being with you next week. And take care. Shabbat shalom.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Shabbat shalom. Good night.